How do you live your life like tomorrow matters? Perhaps you're already growing food, consuming less, connecting with your community. Perhaps you're already thinking hard, keen to see the world a little slower, greener, healthier. But where to begin?
Here on the Future Setting Podcast, we dig deep into the hearts and minds of blissfully normal people doing bloody amazing things, unearthing their moments of contradiction, their hopes and fears for the future, and what galvanizes them to action, in the name of inspiring all of us to do a little more in shaping a better future today. I'm Katie.
And I'm Jade, and this is Future Steady.
So we're here with Diego Benedetto, or the weedy one, as you are on Instagram and out there in the world. And you're a weed advocate and forager who promotes wild food and celebrates the undiscovered, or perhaps more accurately, forgotten resources that are all around us. And of course, these are weeds, plants that we deem scrappy or bothersome, but really represent an incredible source of nutrition and medicine and culture and just connection to our place. So Diego, your enthusiasm for weeds is totally infectious, and I'd really love to hear how you came to love them so dearly.
Hi everyone, I'm Diego, and you're right as the way you introduced me, Katie. I'm renowned to be the weedy guy, the guy who just keep bragging about the wild, undiscovered possibilities growing in everyone's backyard. How did I get to love plants in general? How did I get to love plants? I grew up in a dairy farm in Italy, and when I grew up and where I grew up, it was still common practice to send the kids to collect the wild plants, you know, to go and collect the berries in the forest, the mushrooms, the young dandelions and spring grains in the fields, all of these things that were common practice up to three generations ago all over the world, was still practice where I grew up in my small village in northern Italy. So that's how I started, that's how I learned, that's how I learned to love them. I learned to love them mostly because of food. Just face up, you know, I didn't grow up in a wealthy family, you know, so food was always something that, you know, it wasn't much to go about, yeah. So, you know, go and collect the wild things was part of the supplying of seasonal produce to our larder, to our pickles and jams and whatever else and we did with these wild things. And so that's how I got to learn them, because they're actually yummy.
When you do things for the love of something that's just flat out delicious, there's no other kind of altruistic thing at work. It's just that you love it and you want to put it in your mouth, then that's a really great way to have a very kind of pure sense of enthusiasm, and that's what you're sharing with people. And when I'm on your Instagram, what I'm really delighted by are the stories that you tell about weeds, you know, like the plantain, the gun that we'd always make as kids where you use the seed head and you fire it off at people, or the cheese, the little mallow cheeses. Do you have, I mean, this is obviously a way that you express yourself through story, but do you find that people really respond well to those kind of things rather than a very clinical representation of what this herb might do?
Yes. So I think the best way to engage people with the plants around them is through empowering steps. So by seeking out these childhood memories like daisy chains, like the little guns of plantains, or and so forth, and mulberry, climbing the trees of mulberries and then using the mulberries as lipstick, you know. So we all did that. You remember that. There you have it. That's, I touch you there. So it's you connect straight away, so that you break these the aura of mystery that you might have, you know, is it, you know, this doubt that is it true? Is it this one? Am I not poisoning myself? And I take you straight back into childhood innocence and childhood, you know, boldness in a way where you know exactly what it is, you know exactly what to do with it, and it's yummy and it's totally fine. And that's empowering. That's empowering because, you know, we are so, you know, the more you grow, the more fearful you become. The more you start to question. And with reason, don't stop that. You should question and you should be confident in what you're looking at is what you think it is. But at the same time, you know, abandon yourself. Enjoy the process. Allow yourself to feel the confidence of this relationship between you and the mulberry. And there is no mistake to be made. They are yummy. They are all over the places. Enjoy it.
And also, Diego, I wanted to ask, you have this sense of I guess timeliness. I mean, Katie has said that you have a contagious enthusiasm, and that's really palpable just even, and I've never met you face to face, but even just the way you construct your words around your love of foraging and of discovery of food that is yummy and tasty. I want to know, do you think it's important for people to understand the timeliness in a year? So you often make reference in a lot of your posts, you often make reference of something being available just for this one week. So it's magical and you need to get out there and experience it this week because if you don't, you won't be able to get it next week. Do you think that's something that, you know, it's a bit lost on people now because we have this sense of being able to have whatever we want whenever we want it and, yeah, you know, convenience culture is pretty dominant. And so you kind of giving us the heads up for these amazing little treats we didn't even know existed right under our feet is like a gift, really.
Yes, so how do I answer that? So seasonality is important. Seasonality, okay, becoming aware of seasons is a byproduct of foraging. So foraging does more to you than give you the possibility to take advantage of free food. Is your chance to get to know ecologies, is your chance to create value in front of your eyes, is your chance to experience and practice gratitude for all the gifts that nature has to offer. And it's seasonality is only part of it. Obviously, there is plants that have long seasons, other plants are very short. And it's just what it is. Some, like the mushroom seasons, some years is 4 months old, some year is only 6 weeks. So, you know, and you get to know that, you get to cherish that because then it's always different and it's always typical, and it anchors you to the now and when the things happen. So rather than just engaging with produce that you dismiss because, oh, if I don't get it now, it's, you know, come back tomorrow and that'll be fine, you just you pull yourself back into, okay, I'm looking at these mulberries. If I don't pick them now, and the next time I can come over is in 3 weeks' time, there's none left. So is it a now or next year? And that's important because it cuts away the entitlement that we have as humans towards environment and resources and puts it back into the hands that of cycles which are way beyond our control. So it's a way to practice humble and humbling ways to engage with our surrounding.
There's so many bookmarks that I'm making mentally in what you're saying, because I want to try and revisit as many of these topics as possible. But before we go too much further, I'd love to go back to what you were saying about being a child and having that full kind of confidence that what you're looking at is what you're looking at, and it's maybe pattern recognition or it's a relationship that you have with that plant. And I know that a lot of people, when they start foraging, have that not insecurity, but they're not sure of themselves when they're wanting to identify something. And also then you're in Sydney, I'm in Melbourne, we have this urban context where we're not really sure if a dog has pissed on that herb or if it's been sprayed by the council. And there are all these little things that seem to maybe hamper our confidence in reaching out and touching or harvesting that plant. Are you able to tell us how you kind of coach people through that process, and what? How do we know what's good to eat?
Okay, so in simple steps, I coach people to create some sort of to go through steps that will empower them in being confident on what they're looking at. So steps that are very useful in engaging, particularly in urban foraging. So urban foraging is possible, but you know, there's very few places and far apart where you can actually forage with confidence, okay? Because a whole bunch of reasons. Pollution, pets and their necessities, and management system by council and contractors. So the way to find the places where you can confidently forage, I offer the tool that probably undercuts all of the empower people by giving the tools that will explain it all. The tool that I give people is the best place to forage is your own garden. That means you only ever forage where you know. So it is not that you go out in the environment and you look at them at the dandelions over there in the park and you're trying to double guess whether it's being sprayed or not. If you don't know, you leave it alone. So it's not that you approach foraging like a survivalist, parachuted in the desert Thailand, trying to double guess whether that is the right plant or that is poisonous or not. Yeah. So foraging is not survival. Foraging is taking advantage of seasonal treats from colonies that you are caretaker, colonies that you know very well. So back to you as a kid. When you were a kid, someone told your school that you can eat those mulberries, okay? So you tried once, the day after you're mapping the whole neighborhood, am I right? You go and map the whole neighborhood and find all of the best trees with the best mulberries, yeah? And then you send all of your friends to the bad trees. And so the good trees, you remember it. You remember it and you go back year after year. So that is not a tree that you chance upon. That is the tree that year after year you build your childhood memories. So that's the tree that you would know if someone came and slashed it, or if someone poisoned and so forth. You know, if there is, you know, a dog walking park, so all the dogs come along. I mean, mulberries doesn't matter because up in the branches, but so make sense what I'm saying? So you forage where you know. Foraging is establishing relationships of caretaking rather than double guessing what you're looking at. So the best place to forage is your own garden. You only ever forage when you're 100% confident what you're looking at. So you're not poisoning yourself because you don't experiment trying to work out, you know, is this the one that I saw on the internet? No. If you are at that level, you step back and you go to walk with some uncles and aunties to tell you what you're looking at. So build your knowledge with confidence and only ever engage with what you 100% sure what you're looking at. If you're not 100% sure, you leave it alone.
Can I ask you, Diego, so in my mind, I've sort of foraged on and off for a lot of years, but yeah. I have never lived close to the sea, so I have not done a lot of wild food or wild sea foraging, but you espouse and have confidence and skills not just in the green leaf forage but also in sea foraging. Do the same rules and the same kind of philosophies that you've just spoken of apply for the sea?
Yes. So, yes and no. The rules are always different in terms of rules like legalities. It's always different, depends where you are, who's the manager, stakeholders, and so forth. By the sea, you intertidal zones, quite usually it's commons or federal levels legislations, while in inland urban environment is a puzzle of various interconnected stakeholders from federal to state to local government to private to the mix of the two to crown land, you know, so it's a mess. So in terms of legalities, it's complex. You just need to know what you're stepping into, I mean, in terms of you knowing what kind of authority you should seek. In terms of ethics, is the same thing, because you only ever harvest when there is excess. You harvest in full acknowledgement of the life cycle of the species you're engaging with and the value of this species for other ecologies, for other species. So you don't harvest just because there's a big mound of, a big pile of seaweeds. Oh, let's go and harvest it all and make compost with it, which is great. You can do that, but you're taking away quite an important resource in the lower level of food change of coastal ecologies. There's a lot of species who actually engage with this big pile of seaweeds. In the cities, it's been more complex because often enough, cities' beaches get raked away by the council. They clean the seaweeds from the beach. So you go and collect the seaweeds on a city beach, you're just preventing it from going into landfill. But outside of cities, those piles of seaweeds have more to offer to the ecology than you to make into compost. So harvesting should always be done in full acknowledgement of the complete cycle of the species you're engaging with. Do that a little bit at a time with knowledge.
Yeah. So with sea foraging, I mean, we don't have our own backyard where we can gain confidence of what's in the water and, you know, what will or won't harm us, or, you know, what we're taking, whether it's abundant or not. How do you recommend to people that they kind of begin that tiptoe of a journey to understand, you know, what to forage and when to forage it and how to identify whether there's excess and how to make sure it's safe? It feels to me just like it's a little bit more foreign and a little bit more, I would be a little bit more unsure of it. And I imagine listeners are kind of similar, because the green leaf seems accessible, whereas things that are coming out of the ocean can't ever really be owned by people in their own backyard. And yeah. So I don't know where to begin.
Sea ecologies. So from the start, stay away from marine reserves and national parks. That is true of everything. They're even true of your green leaves that you can find in your inland environments. So you stay away from that because that's protection areas for ecology. So that's already cuts away a whole bunch of area. In terms of pollutants, stay away from outpipes, you know, so when there is stormwater channels coming straight into the sea, which these days in urban and peri-urban environment, it's doesn't happen that often anymore. They just take away into the open sea. But regardless, if it's just there, and particularly, you know, the outpipes, they just take them away in open sea. So other things. So I guess there's a lot of things to learn There's a lot of things to learn. So you just need to take it one step at a time and a little bit at a time. Make it simple. Make it simple. Mm-hmm. Like, choose things that you cannot make a mistake and you can only just taste a little bit. Things like sea lettuce. Sea lettuce is very common throughout all of the coast around, all over the world, really. You know, it's a cosmopolitan species. And very easy to recognize by the look and by the where it grows in intertidal area. It's a green algae. It grows at the highest level of the tide. And you just try a little bit. You just eat a little bit. You know, foraging does not mean filling up buckets with things.
Yeah.
The buckets of foraging, it only ever happens when there is abundance. The vast majority of foraging should only be tasting a handful here and there of treats. That's all should be. We are far too many humans to make buckets of foraging everywhere. That's, you know, that's beyond our scope, beyond our possibilities. So there is certain species, if possible, to get a crate of mushrooms, for example, 5 kilos of mulberries, another example. But the vast majority of people can only get a handful of mushrooms or, you know, a handful of mulberries. That's plenty. You know, that is already a treat to yourself. And that's enough to get you to think and get you to empower you to be an active player and a careful and conscious player into the ecological processes of your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yes, really well said. I'd love to hear your opinion on a theory that I have and permission to laugh me down. But I have this feeling that, you know, we've really been collectively outraged about factory farming of animals, but there's almost a catch-up that we're needing to play with plants, because my theory is that, and I don't think it's actually a theory, this part of it, well proven that plants can respond to people, have feelings that are measurable. What has your experience been of plants as, you know, living, intelligent, conscious entities? Because my theory is we're going to wake up in the future and think, oh my God, look at all this havoc that we've wrecked on the green community and all the things that we've done to plants, thinking that they're kind of these inert things that don't really have feelings. And I'm more and more aware of this when I'm taking from my backyard or picking something that it's probably, this is, I can't separate, you know, the plant and the animal kingdom. They're all part of the web of life. Is this something that you've experienced?
I thank you for that question. So let's just jump in into hippie land. Great. Great. I totally agree with you. So all living things are conscious being. All living things are feelings, now being proven scientifically, and feelings have, not feelings as we intend them, not feelings as they cry or they laugh, but they have responses to outside stimuli, which is what feelings are. So when you engage with plants. Okay, so we all up in arms, so let's go back to the beginning of your question. We all up in arms about factory farming of animals. We should also be up in arms about factory farming of plants. Mm. So it's well known that any produce that you buy in the supermarket shelves is being enslaved into a system of yield, and they are not the same plants with the same capabilities, components, vitamin, minerals, quality of fibers level that the wild plants would have, and therefore offer less. So we need to eat more to get the nutrients that we would get from less amounts if it was a true species, inverted comma, or if it was a wild species. It is understood that the wild species is, on average, 4 times more nutritious than the cultivated ones, because they are true species. They go and fetch their own minerals. They don't get fed water and nitrogen every Tuesday because they are in a farm. Yeah, so they grow out of their own accord, out of their own efforts. Their fiber is true fiber. Their vitamins is true vitamins, and minerals is at levels that is hard to match with cultivated species. That said, modern society, okay, so we have a society only because we've been able to enslave other species. Okay, so the reason why we have a society is because we've been able to create vast amount of nutritional produce into small and controlled environment. We call it agriculture. And through agriculture, we'll be able to allow for bigger and bigger congregations of humans, which is the start of society. Okay, so we are a society because we enslaved species. And that is also animals. Okay, so that comes with this weight and with this drawback. You know, how can I wrap it up? You know, this is opening up a very big ethical dilemma, okay? But at the same time, it's also, we should be honest with ourselves, and we should just stop being hypocritical about it. You know, this is what it is. Let's just not hide it. So the way to go around that is, I don't know how, I don't have a solution for that, but it is necessary to think about it, and most probably the most conscientious way to engage with that is by creating systems that you look after your food sources in a way that they grow in a happy environment, and you are part of that cycle of eating and be eaten into that cycle. Okay, so grow your own food, grow your own animals, eat your own the eggs from your own chicken that you feed with the food from your own garden and so forth. Yeah, so and use all of your outputs as part of that cycles as well. Yeah, so, we went into a big box over there. But you know,
it's a big question.
Let me walk out of that, okay? let's wrap it up as such.
You did very well, and it is, as you said so eloquently but also humbly, we really don't have a solution, and perhaps it is a matter of respect and reverence as well, and intention.
Yes.
Which
and
doesn't.
Intention, yes. Yeah. And gratitude. Mm. Gratitude, yeah.
Yeah. And so, how can people go about cultivating a relationship with a plant beyond kind of foraging it, just being with a plant? Is it about seeing them often, or what do you do?
I think the most successful way, or the best way to cultivate a relationship, is by slowing down, stay put, and be part of a specific environment for the long term. So you settle and you place yourself as part of a specific social and ecological cycle, and that's where you act. And in time, you build knowledge, because one thing that I always amazed time after time of as a forager is that each time I go back to the same field, to the same river, to the same forest, each time I go back, I learn something new. Mm-hmm. It's not that I go back and it's always the same, and so I've been to this walk before. Each time I learn something new. That new learning only is possible because I have the knowledge of what it was before, and then I'd be able to see the next level. Yeah, so there is layers that you peel off from your eyes. You peel off layers from your eyes. As you walk, you see more and more. And you're only able to see more and more because you walked that path over and over again. So time, commitment, careful place, and everything that lives in that place allow for you to see more and more. And by seeing more and more, you become more aware, and you become more entrenched. You know better. You know you to the level that you keep walking to the same footsteps each time, because that's my footstep. I'm not gonna press or crash something else each time. This is the footstep. I humbly just claim that footstep, and I don't want to claim anything more than that. Mm. Make sense what I'm saying?
It does, if only we all embrace that a little more.
Yeah, well.
Slowly.
Slowly. Let's talk about it. Let's be honest. Mm. Let's be humble. And let's pay respect.
Yeah.
Well, do you have a question, Jay?
Should we talk about something funny? Right.
All right. Transition into comedy.
Who want to listen to this? Come on, you know, it's too deep. Too deep, dude.
This is what people like. We want to solve we're trying to solve problems here. Every week we're getting closer and and closer to the perfect solution.
We've almost nailed it. We'll let you know when we get there.
Right.
No, I did want to ask you, Diego, and maybe it's too serious, but maybe you can answer it in a comical fashion. But love when you talk about how we become the steps to becoming caretakers and custodians, and it starts with being an observer and then a stakeholder and then a caretaker. Can you embellish on that? Because I really love that as like a bigger picture principle for how we get people that sounds very coercive, but how people can start to actually care about our environment again, and then you do positive things.
Great. I love the coercing.
I love coercion.
Point of view. I like coercion, you know. Human responds well to that. Blackmailing, coercion. Yeah. That's great way to go about that. All right, so if the goal is to become caretakers, I by the hands, I welcome people into that space by providing tools for them to see value in the landscape. That's why I teach foraging workshop, because all of a sudden people are saying, oh, wow, I had no idea. You know, just, you know, I thought it was just alone, you know, and now, you know, it's common response from people coming to my workshop. They send me emails the day after, you know, just, you know, they respond to my follow-up emails or whatever. I would never be able to see my lawns in the same way. Yeah, so, which is great. I love it. You know, lawns are way more than just grass. And nothing wrong with grass either, okay? But, and so lawns are more than just grass. And once you have the tools to see that, you open up your capability to see value, okay? So humans are funny. Humans is, particularly modern humans, are very entitled, yeah? Everything has to happen to self-gratification, okay? That's what we've been brought up with. It's all about me and what I can do with my life, okay? Totally fine, let's work with that. It's all about your life. I can show you value in your yard. Oh, wow, there's value in my life. Great, cool. Now, how to look after that value? Oh, those bloody council workers, they keep coming and cutting the grass. You know, that's no good. Good. Keep going. Makes sense when I'm going with this?
Yeah, I love it. You're even using the buzzwords, you know, like value adding and value.
Absolutely.
Yeah, business yeah. terms. I love it.
yeah, absolutely. Whatever it takes.
And how do people, I mean, do you have stories about people who have come to your workshops and had a totally kind of eye-opening experience? I'm sure there are lots of people that you take on a journey in the space of a few short hours.
Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of epiphanies coming in for people to come to my workshops. It's mostly related when I get them to taste plants, you know, because, you know, a great ones, which it happens often in my workshop when I introduce, I'm in Sydney, so there is specific plants that in my environment, so this is a specific example, okay? So I introduce to people who do bush regeneration, rambling dog or Turkey rhubarb. Turkey rhubarb, Acetosa sagittata, is a common wild exotics invasive in our environment around here, Sydney Basin, all the way south, further south than Wollongong and so forth. It doesn't have an amazing range, but it's quite big where we are. So if you work in bush regen or if you do volunteering in looking after the environment, which I am great support, you know, I work a lot with bush regeneration. I think we all should do bush regenerations. Yeah, you get free weeds out of it. And true story. So, yeah. And so you get them to taste the plants, they know perfectly well because they've been spending Saturday morning after Saturday morning after Saturday morning filling bags with it. And they never taste it. They never try to actually flavor it. Yeah. And I get them to flavor it and they go, oh, what? I had no idea. You know, I've been pulling this by the bag full every Saturday. I know. You know what? It's incredible. It's so yummy. I know. You know what? Why don't we eat it all the time? You know, don't worry. You know, this is for me because I'm selling those to the chefs. Yet, so you carry on. You pulling out. I'm gonna make money with it. So, and
it's all about the lens you look through, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Say, and it's great. You know, because then. People, you know, still go on a Saturday morning, liberated the bushlands of these problematic invasive. I'm not defending it. Problematic invasives. But, you know, while you liberating the bush, do the first harvest of the top leaves for your fridge and then, you know, carry on with the bags, you know, off you go, off you go.
Yeah, there's no such thing as waste. There's probably no such thing as weeds.
No, weeds is such an arbitrary term. You know, weeds is absolutely anything we don't like. Weeds is a human term for something we didn't plant. It doesn't matter what it is. You know, a rose bush in the middle of a wheat field is a weed.
We chatted with someone not that long ago who said, in fact, people who found organisations often are a bit weedy in their personality because they're good pioneers and they live on the smell of an oily rag. They're happy to kind of get on with things and tie it up with their bootstraps. And at some point they'll move on to the next lot of pasture that needs some work. Yep. But I love the analogy.
Yeah, and when the environment is healthy and they did their job in creating good ecology and microorganisms and good soil, they move on to colonize something else. Weeds, associational plants, that's what they are. This is what
that's
it is.
Right. Yeah, so we should honor them and cheer for them.
Absolutely. Yesterday I was with a bunch of farmers and regenerative agricultural course run by Peter Andrews, Stuart Andrews, the son of Peter Andrews. And anyhow, they talk a lot about weeds and the role as successional plants. So it's important to acknowledge the services of plants. Not just whether we like them or not, you know, it's, you know, they have a role to play.
Before we press record, Diego, you were dispensing a lot of wisdom, and I promised to return to it because I think it's worth sharing. We were chatting about her weaves being people being able to have a great sense of empowerment in the knowledge that there are all these medicinal plants in their backyard, and they're not the same as something you might get at the chemist, even though the it might say St. Mary's thistle on it. It is a totally different thing. Can you elaborate on how empowering it is to return to backyard medicine?
Backyard medicine is what it always been. Backyard medicine is the result of co-evolution. It's like the food plants that we eat. We are what we being able to extract nutrients from. So we are not a species that parachuted down from the stars and all of a sudden, you know, we find food. Oh, I eat this, I don't eat that, that's it, I'm done. You know, we co-evolved with everything around us. So backyard medicine is always been our go-to tools to feed ourselves and to heal ourselves. Now, by giving people tools to recognize important medicinal plants in their own surroundings, because many of the weeds that we talk about and we refer to are not only edible, but they also have important medicinal properties. So by giving the people the tools to recognize these important medicinal plants in their own backyards, at their hands, you give people the chance to be able to empower themselves with the basics of healing. Yeah, things like dandelion, nettle, chickweed, dock, purslane, and so forth. You know, there's plenty that of plants that have very important beneficial healing and nutritional qualities that are readily available in our surrounding. Mallow, southeastern, you know, I keep going. And so by a plantain, you know, shut up. Okay, so...
not us, I guess.
No, not you guys, me. There's too many. All right. So by giving simple tools to people to recognize all of these plants I've been saying, they're in your backyard. Anywhere in Southeast Australia, you will find them. Okay? So these are important medicinal plants. They're the basic tools that everyone can use as folk remedy. Obviously, if you're seriously sick, if you have issues that need to be attended to, you need to go to your doctor, you need to look after yourself. But if you empower yourself with the simple skills of recognizing beneficial plants in your backyard, you'll find out that many of the issues that are aggravated by our lifestyles can be softened down by introducing specific species in our nutritional landscape. Okay, so this is basic knowledge. Yeah, so this is the knowledge of our yayas, our grandmothers, our nonnas, that whenever we come home, they look at us and go, oh, no, 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 you need a tea of this and this, you know? And, you know, why do I need a tea of this? It tastes awful. Don't worry, you know, drink this, you know? And we don't know how good that is, yeah? We don't even recognize how good that is, yeah? Just the tea here and the nourishment of that, a good pie of good food, you know, a good chicken broth, and you know, things like that, you know, how important is this simple step of self-care and empowering this simple step of self-care.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like it. We've been so good at outsourcing most things in our lives that even kind of self-care falls into that category as well, whereas we've actually got this plethora of tools that are just at our back doorstep and under our noses or under our toes that would give us the ability to really embrace the simplest of self-care and not outsource it but actually own it and kind of have it at our
practice. And practice. Yeah.
And do you think we need to take responsibility for being that reconnection? I feel like I'm part of a generation where, as you mentioned, you know, a few generations ago, this was common knowledge, nothing to talk on a podcast about. It's just everyone knew it. Whereas now it's like, wow, this is brilliant. We want to hear from Diego because you are the keeper of this wisdom that we, my
Me?
Generation,
okay.
haven't. You specifically. You, tingling. But okay. I don't have access to it. I haven't been steeped in that from a young age. And so I wonder if it is a matter of tooling myself up so then we can kind of reconnect the generations with just human wisdom. Is that something that you feel like you're serving as well by holding workshops and helping educate people and then get the flow back again of people
yes.
knowing how so, to take care of themselves?
Absolutely. So, Katie, you're already doing it. You're already seeking out the knowledge. You know, don't belittle all of this investigation you do with your growing your own food, with seeking, looking after your community, and all of these things. They're all important steps of self-care. So it doesn't matter if you grew up with a yaya or grew up with a nonna or not. This knowledge is part of who you are, it's part of who we are. So it was common knowledge 3 generations ago. That means it's not in the remote Neolithic times. It's in within our lived memories, yeah? So it's not too far away. Yes, you know, there's people who know more than others. There's always going to be people who know more than others. And I do not own any key to any special box of knowledge. I'm just someone that accumulated stories and I'm willing to share. And people also have stories to share. Just go around, seek and mix and match, make do with what you got, and enjoy the process. And you know, no one is perfect, you know, so you know, yeah, just go empower yourself and you know, enjoy the journey. We got a long way to go, and you know, let's just keep moving, really, you know. Yeah.
Feed the thirst for it and just explore and discover.
Explore and just empower yourself with what you know and share that. And from there, you know, more comes at you. You know, there's, I keep saying one thing which usually people respond quite well. There is no bigger teacher. There is no more, there's no better teacher than curiosity. If you want to know, you find out. Good things to do is take your time. Take your time, enjoy the process. So foraging, it can be as simple as picking a lily pilly from the hedges of the car park, yeah? Foraging can be, so even better. I'll give you an empowering tools straight away. Foraging is part of us. We are hunter-gatherers. This is, as a species, we collect things from our surrounding, yeah? So, and we are omnivorous, so we eat all sorts of things, okay? So we are very well-versed to engage with a very wide range of things of nutrition, of produce and nutritional, of nutritional value. So we all engage with all of us, yeah? So it's not something that is foreign to you. For example, mulberries is a great example because lots of people had the experience of mulberries as young kids, yeah? So empower yourself with that experience. Mulberries, in my opinion, as one of the most important teacher species that we have in Southeast Australia and elsewhere. Yeah, all over the world, really. Why is that? Because it's very child-friendly and is very, it's all over the places. It grows like a weed, you know, just it grows out of, you know, in people's gutters and things like that. And people doesn't plant it, you know, just all over the places. Very common fruit trees. Mulberry taught you seasonality, as in, once you know about mulberries, you wait for months for them to come back. So there it is. That's your seasonality lesson. You know, you even go, you know, you're waiting for them and they're nearly ready, then you go and try one and it's not ready yet, and you know, it's too sharp, you know, and then you come back the week after, far out, it's not ready yet. And then when you're ready, when they're ready, you are ready. You've been there stalking these mulberries for at least 3 or 4 weeks before even they get there. So you didn't chance on the mulberries. You've been there stalking them. So that's another great lesson. Yeah, you are a caretaker. Yeah, stakeholder. You are a stakeholder. Okay. Mulberries, it's universal because, you know, you go out around the mulberry trees and you go there with your mates. And then, you know, one Saturday afternoon, you see there's another family over there picking mulberries. Oh, what are they doing? They're picking mulberries too. I thought I was the only one knowing it. Yeah. So mulberries also teach you that resources are not just for you. Resources are for everyone. Resources are for share. Next level. Mulberries is part, eating mulberries is part of our ecological contract with the species. Okay, so mulberries evolve to make fat, juicy berries so that the mammals will go there and eat them and then do their thing somewhere else. Okay, so it is our biological contract, our ecological contract to go and eat the mulberries, all right? So it is your obligation. So you don't just do a disfavor to the trees. So it's part of your job. You, mammal, need to eat mulberries, okay? So further on, by eating mulberries, whenever you go around eating mulberries, you pick all of the good ones, the ready ones from the branches, okay? By picking off, selective harvesting mulberries from the branches, you take away the weight from the branches, preventing the branches from breaking, because as they get bigger and bigger, the weight will break the branches. By taking away the mulberries who are ready from the branches, you prevent the fruit to rot on the tree by creating infestation with worms and fruit flies and everything else, okay? So if the mulberries got fruit flies, if they got little worms, it's because you didn't harvest fast enough. By collecting the mulberries who are ready, you prevent the fruit to going on the floor, making mess on the footpath, preventing the neighbor to come there the day after, killing the tree with the chainsaw, okay? So it is your ecological contract to go and eat the mulberries. Off you go.
I especially love that, Diego, because it flies in the face of the whole, you know, humans aren't meant to be impacting the world in any way narrative that it is tempting to subscribe to. But you've just, yes, you put us right back in there in the cycle. And I think that is such a beautiful, joyous way of looking at it.
Yeah, we are part of the cycle. You know what? There's a very interesting anthropologist, Ingold, Tim Ingold from Aberdeen University, writes a lot about how we think as humans to go and inspect and analyze ecologies in other situations, in other environments. And we analyze it like if we were on a helicopter looking down with the binoculars, yeah? Like, just because we are stepping into the environment, we are altering how the environment is responding. So whatever we're looking at is need to acknowledge the fact that we are part of it. Makes sense? I simplified so much. I simplified the whole PhD into two sentences. So, but anyhow, right.
That's what we love. We love the simple sound bites that we can pop on the show notes for people. Oh, and I'm so happy that my neighbor has a massive mulberry tree, but it's a neighbor that I don't know. So I might have to like slip a greeting card into their letterbox just very innocently and try and cultivate a friendship with that said neighbor so that we can pillage their mulberry tree.
Are they harvesting?
Offer to make cookies.
No, they're not quite ready yet. Yeah, I'll swap them for cookies.
All right, yep. There you have it. You have the members. You're keeping an eye on it. So very good.
I'm salivating. They're just amazing. Oh, thank you so much, Diego. I feel really uplifted by your conversation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy. I'm happy for that. Yeah.
We hope you enjoyed that conversation with Diego Bonetto as much as we did. I could just listen to him wax weedy all day long. If you want to stalk Diego, you can find him at The Weedy One on Instagram or at diegobonetto.com, and that's one N, two T's. We have some pretty stellar guests coming up, actually very stellar, the stellarest. We know we say that all the time, we're kind of running out of superlatives, but they're just getting better and better, these conversations. Next week, we have Anthea Koulouros, another Sydney cider and another health wizard, or actually a white witch in Anthea's case. If you don't know Anthea, stick around for this spiritual, mystical, edible and herbal chat. That's with Anthea next week on Monday. And we also have more Buy Me a Cuppa donors to thank. Once again, you've all really lifted our spirits and made our week with your generous donations on our buymeacoffee.com/futurestudying page. We've changed it to cuppa because we get all jittery with caffeine. Woo! So this week, Patrick and Darcy bought us four cuppas. Legends, thank you. Someone, very mysterious, bought us five cuppas. We're very quizzical over that one, but thank you, someone. No less grateful for your donation. Anna Trigg brought us three cuppas and said, I've learned so much from you and your guests. Thank you for doing this. Thank you, Anna. That's very, very generous of you indeed. Marcella brought us five cuppas. She said that she hopes our conversations find their way into many more ears. That's very lovely of you, Marcella. We are glad you're enjoying it, and we hope lots more people can enjoy the wisdom of our guests too. And lastly, we have Jenny, aka Milk, Bread, Eggs, Honey on Instagram. She bought us five cuppas and said, adore you dynamic ladies, clever, considered, can do tips with insightful interviews and endless enthusiasm. Woo! Yes, we are enthusiastic and we're very enthusiastic about your contributions. Thanks to everyone. If you wanted to hop on to buymeacoffee.com/futurestudying, you can. We're always up for cuppas. Our bladders are very strong. And we hope to see you next week with our conversation with Anthea Koulouros. See you then.